Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning is Anderson against Catholic Bishop of Chicago and others, and we're ready to hear from Mr. Glass.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Judge Wood, Judge Cudahy, and Judge Rovner. It's a great honor to be here and to address this panel. On November 8th, this court instructed the parties to be prepared to discuss at oral argument the question of finality of the district court's judgment under 28 U.S.C. 1291 in light of the fact that the July 23, 2013, order appeal from dismissing count one with prejudice, that is the subject, forms the subject of this appeal, was followed on July 23rd by a sua sponte order by the district judge dismissing the co-defendant Holy See without prejudice until valid services obtained, and in light of appellant's representation at page 14 of their opening brief that they intend upon remand to pursue service through diplomatic channels under the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. So,
right. So the court's concern is simple. When there are multiple parties in a lawsuit, final judgment isn't normally there unless there's been a final disposition as to all parties. And this looks like a distinctively not final disposition of the Holy See. And I don't believe, although you can correct me if I'm wrong, that there's any Rule 54 order in this file.
Well, Your Honor, I attempted to file an appellate rule 28J supplemental authorities letter this morning in paper form, and your clerk did not accept it because it was not e-filed. I intend to e-file it today. I served a copy on counsel.
Well, why don't you just address the merits of the question? I at least am concerned about finality because of this rather clear indication to me that you're not finished yet with the Holy See. And so what I would ask you is to talk about two possible outcomes. Outcome number one, we agree with you and the case goes further against the Catholic Bishop of Chicago. Outcome number two, we don't agree with you and we think that the case against the Catholic Bishop was properly disposed of. What's going to happen to the Holy See in either one of those cases?
Well, Rule 54B contains seven important words. There's no just reason to delay.
But there's no order that the district court has entered. The district court has to enter such an order.
Indeed. However, the district court need not use the talismanic phrase, there is no just reason for delay, as long as the district court's order clearly contains the express determination that Rule 54B requires, and I'm going to attempt to tease that out for the court, looking at the four factors that Rule 54B certification turns on.
And go ahead.
There is no 54B judgment in this case, is there?
Not expressly. Appellant takes the position that it is there in the totality of the two orders that were previously mentioned.
I've not ever seen anything like that, so you're going to have to really help me.
Okay. These factors include...
Before you get into the factors, maybe just to follow up on what Judge Rovner just said, are you familiar with any case in which this court has gone ahead and assumed that there was a 54B final judgment in which the district court never said, I'm ordering final judgment for purposes of 54B? Forget about the talismanic language or anything. I haven't seen any.
I'm not aware of one either, Your Honor, and I was hoping that this would be the very first case in the Seventh Circuit on that point.
But the reason not to do that, just to put the policy on the table, is that finality is a very important moment for purposes of transfer of jurisdiction from the district court to the Court of Appeals. And there are many rules and many reasons to try to make that as clear as possible. So that's why we have Rule 58 separate pieces of paper for final judgments. That's why the rules talk about, you know, a particular number of days, 150 days, if for some reason there isn't that. There are many rules that are designed to make this transfer as clear as possible. And if you're going to take the position that henceforth we're going to have to delve into every last word that district judges have said to figure out if there's some kind of functional Rule 54 order, it's a hard road to go down.
Well, it's the road that lies in front of me this morning, Your Honor.
Okay. Fair enough.
We're trying to figure out if it lies in front of us.
Exactly.
Well, that's what I'm trying to explain. And
well, you can give us your best shot, but I would suggest that maybe then you move on to whatever else you want to say.
All right. Well, factor three is the possibility that the appellate court may have to consider the same issue on appeal a second time. And now I will spin out this possibility. This court may very well decide to dismiss this appeal without prejudice, landing the parties back in the district court. The plaintiff could take a voluntary non-suit against the Holy See and then bring back up the count one, and it would be the self-same appeal that is before the court this morning in large part.
With the additional clarity that you're not trying to pursue any relief against the Holy See. I assume you have some reason for having named them, so I'm not sure that's a trivial difference.
Well, it's a dismissed party at this point, without prejudice. And that was done sua sponte on the court's own motion. The district court also saw fit to quash the service of process by international registered mail that was, in fact, executed and filed with the district court clerk in about March of 2012. But be that as it may, the first factor for 54B is the fourth factor. Miscellaneous factors such as delay, economic considerations, expense, etc. Well, that is the mirror image of factor three, the one that I just explained, only in reverse, meaning by delaying this appeal and allowing the proceedings in the district court to proceed against the Holy See, a tremendous amount, assuming that discovery was taken, even class discovery was taken, a tremendous amount of time, effort, energy, and expense would be expended before this case.
Well, that's why you should have gone to the district court at that moment and said, we are seeking an order under 54B that would say there's no just reason for delay, et cetera, that the appeal against the Catholic bishop of Chicago should go forward. That's the way the system is supposed to work. Then the district court gets to think about it, gets to think about how separate the two theories are and move ahead.
Well, and the court is precisely correct, and I stand admonished. In retrospect, it never looks good for counsel or even the court to find themselves in this situation.
You know, I think we should maybe have you answer a couple of other questions as you're here.
Very well.
And I really do have one because you argued that the defendants agreed not to assert the statute of repose in remaining silent in light of your offer. But that letter with the offer stated that if they failed to respond within 1 week, you would proceed with the litigation. Now, doesn't that establish that silence would be construed as a rejection of the offer, not an acceptance of it?
Well, perhaps that's couched in terms of a negative option, Your Honor. But the reality is the parties did proceed to pursue investigation of these claims without the filing of any lawsuit, without the demand that a lawsuit be filed. And so the actions of the parties fulfilled the language of that letter that the court is referring to.
But what's the support for treating that letter as an affirmative representation by the defendant that it would not pursue the limitations defense? I really cannot see that.
Well, there is another letter, Your Honor, a later letter, in which the counsel for the Catholic bishop stated in sum and substance, and it's also attached as an exhibit to the complaint, that to count one, that the Mr. Anderson's individual sex abuse claim is time barred under both the statute of repose and the statute of limitations. Nevertheless, the Catholic bishop chose to treat this not so much as a legal matter, but rather to deal with it on a compassionate basis. And therefore, the Catholic bishop, through its counsel, requested a statement as to what it would take from Mr. Anderson to heal, which was in the nature of a settlement offer or broaching settlement discussions.
It was an opening for a settlement discussion, but I have to say, as the Catholic bishop has argued, I'm very troubled by the implications of a rule that would say as soon as one party says, you know, apart from the law, you know, is there some path that would allow us to resolve this dispute, to take that as a waiver of available defenses, whether they're limitations defenses, whether they're some other type of defenses, would put a terrible chilling effect on any kind of settlement discussions. Parties usually have different views of the law.
Well, Your Honor, you're putting your finger on what I feel is the crux of the matter, and that's the relationship between the adjudicated and the unadjudicated claims. The adjudicated claim against Mr. Anderson vis-a-vis the Catholic bishop, and the unadjudicated claims as to the Holy See. And the dismissal with prejudice of the individual sex abuse claim is now the law of the case. And the real rub is that in this particular case, under these particular theories of waiver under various waiver and estoppel under various guises of the interposition of the statute of limitations and repose, the plaintiff must wear its heart on its sleeve. The plaintiff's individual claim must appear to be time-barred. And this provides a perfect platform, at least in the appellant's view, to proceed to class discovery and find out for once and for all whether it is the Holy See's policy to waive limitations and repose.
What do you mean by policy? I don't understand that.
Well,
you're saying if you waive it in one case, you got to waive it in every other case. That's the essence of your argument here, I think.
Well, we alleged the class allegations alleged that the Holy See, through its archdiocese and diocese in the United States and United States Commonwealth, wholesale settled numerous stale pre-sex abuse claims
Well, that's pretty obvious. What's that got to do with this case?
Well, if this case plugs into that scheme and seeks to elaborate it.
Look, if a defendant chooses to settle a claim rather than assert a valid legal defense of it, why would that ever preclude a defendant from asserting that legal defense in another case? It would be against public policy to hinder voluntary settlement of claims. They have certainly they have the right to say yes to him and no to you.
And even if they say no hundreds and hundreds and thousands of times?
Well, then people bring cases and we decide those hundreds and thousands and millions of cases.
But your own allegations indicate that sometimes they settle and sometimes they don't. You have a theory that it has to do with how wealthy the diocese is, but pulling back, I mean, you're not even saying they always settle and the only person with whom they did not settle was Mr. Anderson.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no, and that's, as Judge Rovner is suggesting, is very typical.
The allegation is of a patchwork approach based on economic considerations whereby Rome, we believe, directs the richer diocese who have the funds to settle their cases to do so, and the poorer diocese who do not have the funds to not do so, so that Rome would not be ultimately responsible for any of the settlement money.
Does that factor affect every settlement by every defendant?
Well, these...
It's a legitimate consideration, it seems to me. But if you haven't got any money, you can't settle, can you?
There is also an allegation in this complaint that on the heels of the 2002 Dallas Convention by the American bishops who were treating a child sex abuse policy, there was, and I believe that the secretary to that may have been Justice Ann Burke of the Illinois Supreme Court, there was an initiative to include not only pastoral relief, but also damages, money damages, in the revised policy. And we allege in the complaint that that was sent to Rome, and the Pope struck the word "and damages" out. That goes to a policy.
Well, if you would like to save any rebuttal time, I'll just warn you that you are into your rebuttal time. You don't have to. You can use it now if you want, but you've used it.
Well, if the panel has any other questions, I'd be happy to attempt to answer them.
I think we'll save them for
maybe.
You.
Maybe we will after.
Thank you very much.
May it please the Court. I'm James Gioli for the Catholic Bishop. In a case called Doss, this court, in an opinion written by Judge Wood, referred to a situation where one party is dismissed without prejudice and the other party is dismissed with prejudice as canonically non-final, maybe an appropriate term for today. But the court also said that there were two recognized exceptions to that approach, which maybe we could talk about as dispensation for today. And that one of the exceptions apparently would not apply here, and that is where the case below is clearly over, where the district court has sort of done the equivalent of Rule 54B and made it clear that nothing else can happen in the case, and we're not going to try to argue that that's what happened here. But the other recognized exception is when the party or the claims dismissed without prejudice are on their face barred by the statute of limitations or the statute of repose. And that was the case in Doss. And that was in a case called Cardenas. And we can supply the citations for the court. I'm sorry we didn't get a supplemental authority to the court before today, but we can provide the cases after the argument. Cardenas was, in fact, failure to serve situation involving a police officer where the individual officer was not served and the city of Chicago was served. And the claims
against... It's a little different, isn't it? Because if somebody's not served, they never actually get into the case.
The Holy See was dismissed without prejudice because it was not served.
Service was quashed. And then... So there was an effort at service that the court finds inadequate, I guess.
Without getting too hung up on terms of art, Your Honor, there was not a proceeding involving a motion to quash service. The district court simply did not recognize the attempted service against the Holy See. Holy See never filed a limited appearance in quash service. The court simply did not believe that the plaintiffs had actually accomplished service pursuant to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act.
What worries me most of all about this is the statement, well, both the statement without prejudice until valid service is obtained, which reads to me like an extension of time in which to perform service, and secondly, the statement in the appellant's brief that they intend upon remand to pursue service through diplomatic channels. Obviously, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act has a couple of alternative ways in which service can be accomplished.
I think that if we assume that the district court fully intended to allow the plaintiffs to continue to attempt to serve the Holy See, and if we take the plaintiffs at their word that they have no intention of dropping the purported claims against the Holy See and they wish to try to pursue those claims, I think we have to assume that for the purposes of today. I'd like to at least sketch an argument for you that under Doss and under Cardenas, nonetheless, you can treat the order dismissing the Catholic bishop with prejudice as final and appealable. And that is because when on the record it is apparent that the claims that have not come before the court would be time-barred, that is the recognized exception that this court has found to this finality problem. And here, we don't have to go very far to understand why that would be so. It has to do with the pleading itself, and that is this. The claims that were the purported putative class representative, Mr. Anderson, has a particular set of claims to create this lawsuit. Every allegation he makes that purportedly creates liability, every claim he's making is against the Catholic Bishop of Chicago. His only means for suing the Holy See is vicarious. It's only on the argument that the Catholic Bishop is somehow an agent of the Holy See and the Catholic Bishop's agents are agents of the Holy See.
He was trying to say, anyhow, that it was, in fact, the Holy See that created the policy that the Catholic Bishop of Chicago and, for that matter, anywhere else in the world is following. And if that's the case, if it's a direct lawsuit against the creator of the policy, I'm not sure that's vicarious.
Well, let's get more specific here. The Catholic bishop was dismissed with prejudice because of the statute of repose.
Right. Huh?
So irrespective of that policy argument, the injuries Mr. Anderson alleges are covered by that statute of repose. It's a diversity case for the purposes of the underlying tort, and under Illinois law, the statute of limitations or repose applies based on the injury one suffers, not the liability theory one alleges.
And so your argument is almost a standing argument that he, even if he was injured by this policy, the injury itself is so stale that he can't pursue the Holy See for any relief.
As a matter of law, any claim against the Holy See is for an injury that is barred by 13-202.2b. And for that reason, on the record, the court can find that this case is like Doss and therefore is a final and appealable judgment. The Illinois Supreme Court in the Doe versus Diocese of Dallas case specifically reaffirms this type of injury argument and holds that it doesn't matter what kind of a theory the plaintiff brings. What matters is what injuries is the plaintiff asserting. And there are no independent injuries. There are no independent claims. There's nothing Mr. Anderson alleges that isn't somehow the child sexual abuse injury at the end of the day as his actual claim, the thing for which he's claiming damage. And that claim, as a matter of law, as Judge Castillo held, is time-barred. And there's no distinct liability of the Holy See other than for the very same conduct, for the very same claim that would be barred by the very same statute of repose.
Is there any standard that the defendants use to determine whether to assert the limitations defense or whether to settle a claim?
I guess I would start by saying that obviously every party has an absolute right to decide when they want to defend a case and when they want to settle a case. Mm-hmm. But I don't have any hesitation in saying that the Archdiocese of Chicago and the Catholic Bishop of Chicago, who is simply the corporate form of the Archdiocese, has an overall compassionate approach in situations like this, and its general attempt is to resolve these cases. But on a case-by-case basis, there are a lot of factors that go into whether you settle a case, ranging from the level of credibility you attach to the allegation, the resources available to a charitable institution, quite frankly, the age of the claim. These allegations come from 1959, 58, 1960. It can be very, very difficult to assess the validity of a claim like that many, many decades later. This is a situation, not in the record on appeal, but just as long as you've asked the question, this is a situation in which the accused person, or one of them, has categorically denied this. And there's no reason to believe that the allegation is true from the Catholic bishop's point of view. The Catholic bishop, the archdiocese, has a process for evaluating allegations against priests and former priests. And it involves a review board that includes lay people and an investigative process. This matter went to the review board. It was not substantiated. I mean, there are a lot of things that happen in individual cases. It's a careful, deliberative process. It's definitely not a mechanical formula. We have settled many cases. We have not settled other cases. I also don't mind saying on the record that we don't take direction to settle a case or not settle a case from other entities, including the Holy See. The Archdiocese is led by a Cardinal Archbishop. That's where the policy is made, and that's where the decisions are made. Let me turn to the merits of the claim, as long as we're there. I think the court's questions were properly skeptical of the theory in the case. There is really no authority anywhere for the idea that if you settle a claim in one case, then you have somehow waived the right to settle that claim in another case. We've cited a case, and for that reason, it's hard to find cases to argue against the theory. But there is a case we cited, I believe the name is Reimer, involving a party that settled a previous claim or failed to assert the statute of limitations in a previous case, and the court held that was not a waiver of its right to assert the statute of limitations in a subsequent litigation. The previous case was voluntarily dismissed or dismissed without prejudice. But
so
even
what
that
I wonder,
is not a force.
Excuse me. What I wonder is whether, in Mr. Anderson's case in particular, any of the correspondence that was exchanged, any of the letters, particularly the one, you know, rather than treat this as a strictly legal matter, respond compassionately, you know, is that enough of a hook to make somebody reasonably think that there is a waiver in that case, at least, that we're not going to assert these defenses?
I think just the opposite is true. Paragraph 1, here are the statutes and the cases that say you lose. You have no claim. You cannot proceed. By the way, we may be willing to be nice to you. We may be willing to be compassionate. The word in the letter is compassionate. And that's a matter of if perhaps there's some pastoral care that would help you in the situation. That's something we might consider offering. Tell us what you might have in mind.
But why would pastoral care not be offered anyway? I mean, does the Catholic Church charge when people come see a priest?
No, the point I'm making is that the expression of a willingness to offer pastoral care has no bearing on the Catholic bishop's right or decision that if it got sued, it would assert the statute of limitations. Even if we went further and construed that as some kind of a request for a settlement demand, requesting a settlement demand does not waive your defenses. If it did, nobody would ever settle a case. And that's really the public policy argument that the court was alluding to. The whole approach the plaintiffs are taking would shut down the ability of parties to explore settlement, to investigate the other side's claims, to entertain in a free exchange of ideas, is it worth it for us to avoid this lawsuit or not? Even if we think we will win when we proceed, why wouldn't we find out what it would cost not to go to court? I mean, it's just so fundamental that it's almost difficult to articulate as a legal principle. But that's the point. And I think the correspondence attached to the complaint becomes a part of the pleading and establishes the kind of absurdity of the tolling argument that the plaintiffs have made. I think the briefs pretty clearly establish why the claim is time-barred. Let me just say a word about Judge Castillo's decision not to grant leave to amend the complaint. The complaint, all through the litigation, through to the initial judgment, the plaintiffs made no attempt to amend the complaint. We filed a pretty explicit, specific motion to dismiss that alerted the plaintiffs to the exact defects in their complaint. And in response, they chose to oppose the motion. At that point, they could have sought leave to amend and added any theories they wanted, but they did not do that. And they didn't do it while the motion was taken under advisement. They didn't seek to amend the complaint until after judgment on a Rule 60 motion, which the court treated as a Rule 59 motion. So they really didn't have the right to amend the complaint at that point. They waived it. But even so, the proposed amended complaint did not do anything to cure the problems. For one thing, none of the proffered allegations are as to the Catholic bishop. So they really don't go to the judgment that Judge Castillo entered. For another thing, they're purely conclusory. There are no facts there. So again, pardon me, it wouldn't have changed anything. And finally, in the motion papers attached, I believe it was the Rule 60 motion, Mr. Anderson proffers an affidavit, paragraph 7 of which admits his full knowledge of his injuries and even of the settlement practices of the Catholic Church, quote unquote, in the 1990s.
Even if you thought that was ambiguous, I thought maybe the final line of defense was the April 15, 2005 letter, which is still too far back.
It's too far back because the suit was filed in 2011, and if they were trying to allege fraudulent concealment, 13-215 is a 5-year
right,
statute. So precisely right, Judge Wood. It's a self-defeating record there. If Judge Castillo had ever gotten past the procedural part, and he did in his reasoning, it was a futile act, and there would have been no point in allowing leave to amend on that proffer. The final topic I plan to deal with the court is whether or not the district court should have addressed class issues. We cover it in the brief. There's nothing improper where the putative class representative cannot proceed with the case for the court to deal with that up front so that we're not wasting years of litigation time in the district court on what is in essence an insufficient class plaintiff. If he can't be a member of the class, there's no typicality. If he can't proceed with cognizable claims, he can't be a member of the class. There was nothing improper in adjudicating the Catholic bishop's motion when the court did. And as to discovery, the plaintiff never requested discovery, never attempted discovery. So that's really not an argument for reversal. If the court has no more questions, I'll get back the rest of my time.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Glass?
First of all, the appellant maintains that it is a fact issue, Your Honors. It's a fact issue about this policy, about Rome's policy, and about the actual conduct in these 50 states. No discovery was ever taken, so there can be no, at this point, finding one way or the other of agency between the Holy See and the various dioceses here. And unfortunately, the plaintiff never had an opportunity to pursue that because the plaintiff was surprised that the case would be shut down so quickly. Candidly, the plaintiff did not file a motion for class discovery under Rule 23. The plaintiff alleged excusable neglect in the Rule 60 motion, and the district court overruled that on the basis that it was raised for the first time in reply. Rule 60 has a savings provision, and Rule 59 does as well, that says the district court can grant these motions for any reason stated in the pleadings or for any reason not stated in the pleadings or not even in the record. And counsel pointed out all the reasons why the plaintiff's case is deficient, but the plaintiff's complaint was sufficient under federal notice pleading. The discovery was never taken, but should have been taken, on these fact issues that inform the class issues.
It's hard to get to the should have been taken without a request.
Yes.
On the record. Judges don't just order discovery themselves. We have a party-driven system.
That's true, Your Honor. Furthermore, there was an attempt to, in dismissing count one, Judge Castillo stated in his memorandum order and opinion that the plaintiff had failed to supply or allege sufficient specific examples of time-barred sex abuse claims that were settled either through the confidential claims process or in litigation, and essentially invited the plaintiff to supplement that, which the plaintiff did in its Rule 59 and 60 motions, and that triggered the conversion rule, which would mean it would no longer be 12B6 country, but summary judgment country, Your Honor, and that would imply discovery and a fuller factual elaboration of the record.
Okay. I think you need to wrap up now.
As to the attempted amended complaint, the district court shot that down as well.
I think we have your arguments, and we will take the case under advisement.
And we did allege a change in the law, Your Honor, right. Jackie's law, which became effective in about 2008 and right. suspended the statute of limitations.
Thank you, Mr. Glass.
Thank
that
you so
do.
Much.
Thanks to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.